Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Well, about 217 years and change ago, a group of white men, actually, but quite wise white men, got together and wrote the Constitution of the United States. And, of course, it was ratified by 9 of the 13 colonies. 3 quickly followed suit, and we began the nation we were today. At the time, hey, constitutional government was kind of a radical idea. The British Parliament already existed, but anything that they passed, and of course they didn't have full power with the king there, but for any democracy, any law that they passed could be changed. Simply whatever the majority wanted, the majority ruled. And that was the understanding of democracy. After all, that's what pure democracy is. But when Thomas Jefferson sat down to write the Declaration of Independence, he said that we hold certain truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Thomas Jefferson believed that there are certain truths, things like the equality of man, that really trump any majority laws. Now, of course, the irony is that Jefferson was a slave owner, and of course he didn't include women in his remarks. But the idea that there are certain principles, one being the equality under the law, that trump even what a majority says is a principle that begins back with the Declaration of Independence and continues to this day. And if we look at the recent news that's going on, with the Bush administration and the Republicans in Congress, who are really in control of all the levers of power in the federal government, right? I mean, there's a Republican president, there is a Republican House, a Republican Senate, 7 of the 9 Supreme Court justices are Republican. We find, interestingly, that the one thing that's restraining them, the only thing, is the Constitution. Let me give you a few examples. Whether it's the town hall meetings Bush is holding, the recent controversy over Terri Schiavo, the planes of people that we send to foreign countries to be tortured, or whether it's imprisoning people in jails forever in the United States without trial, all things very much part of what the Bush administration cares a lot about and spends a lot of time on, we see that the one thing left putting a roadblock in the path of this administration happens to be the Constitution of the United States. And it's interesting that, I think sometimes liberals are given a mistreatment because conservatives claim the Constitution just as they claim the flag and they claim a lot of things that really belong to all of us as Americans. But what's interesting is that some of those who claim to revere the Constitution most have never read the thing. Clearly don't understand it, clearly don't know what's in it. And I would invite all of you, lawyer or non-lawyer, to pick up your pocket constitution. It's pretty short, doesn't take that long, and read through it. And in the next hour, I want to talk about the issues of today and how it is that the Constitution continues to play an enduring role and why I argue that it's really the one thing that stands between us and tyranny. Let's talk, for example, about those town hall meetings. Now, town hall meetings, of course, well, they've existed a long time in America. They began in New England, and they were a clear example of direct democracy. Everyone in the town would get together, or most people in the town. Of course, again, it needs to be pointed out, 200 years ago, they were mostly white, male, Christian property owners. They're about the only ones who were allowed to participate, but at least all the white, male, Christian property owners would be able to get together and discuss the issues of the day and sometimes make policy. And the idea of a town hall meeting has come down from those early days in New England all the way up to the present day as an idea where citizens of good meaning but perhaps differing views come together in a public forum from all over the town and air their differences and try to resolve conclusions. Well, George Bush is the first to call a town hall meeting what is a staged propaganda event. He really is the first to do that. I'm not aware, and maybe if you are, you could call in and let me know, but I'm not aware of any other president who ever staged a town hall meeting until George Bush. But one of the interesting things that's come up in these town hall meetings is, as you probably know, for the last 4 years, George Bush does not allow free speech at his town hall meetings. Every single word people say is carefully scripted. His men tell the people what to say. If they don't like what the person's going to say, the person is not allowed to say it. But there's actually gone much, much further than that. If you want to attend a public town hall meeting and you hold views that differ from the president's views, you are kicked out of the meeting. Now, these, of course, are public events, events open to the public, but actually, of course, they're not. And we have seen instance after instance where people have held views differing from the president and have been rudely, sometimes quite physically, kicked out. The most recent incident I read in the Washington Post today, there was one of these Social Security town hall meetings, and it was generally understood that you were not allowed to speak at this meeting unless you already agreed with the president's proposal. After all, the purpose of the town hall meeting is not to hear questions from and to convince the people in the room. The purpose of the meeting is to pose for the cameras to try to convince the people at home. So it was very clear that you were not allowed to speak out if you didn't already agree with the president. But there were three people that came in, didn't speak, didn't say a word. But on their cars, there were bumper stickers that suggested that they didn't support the president's agenda in Iraq. Had nothing to do with Social Security. And when the president's men found those cars and traced them to the people in the room, saw that there were bumper stickers against the war in Iraq, they called out the police and all of those people were booted out of the hearing, quite roughly, I might add. And, of course, the people are thinking of suing. They're thinking of suing because they had every right to be at the event. In fact, their tickets were handed to them by their Republican congressman. Generally, only Republicans are allowed to invite people to Bush's town hall meeting. And but they disagreed with the Bush on Iraq, and they weren't allowed to attend a public gathering based solely on their views. Well, I hope they do sue. It will be an interesting suit because, of course, the Constitution says, and the First Amendment to the Constitution, it says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Now, if you are not free to speak in any forum for fear of punishment, that's abridging freedom of speech. Now, obviously, you can say, well, at the president's pre-selected propaganda events, okay, in that case, we can't allow people to speak contrary views. It's dishonest because you're calling it a town hall meeting when you should call it, you know, Bush propaganda event. So it's dishonest, but you could say you can't speak at the meeting. But the question will be whether someone can be removed from a public gathering solely because of their views on another issue. It'll be an interesting case. Let me talk about a few more constitutional issues. By the way, you're always welcome to call in and join this discussion. Toll-free number 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you could write on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. A few more issues, and I won't – there's the issue of Terry Schiavo. There's the issue of the separation of powers, whether or not Congress or the courts had the right to determine her case. There's the question of torture, of habeas corpus review. Again, article in the newspaper today where we had the courts say that guess what? You cannot do, as the Bush administration has done, send people to be tortured in another country. Now, this, of course, is a very frequent practice of the Bush administration and one that, I don't know, it's gotten some press, but not a lot of press because the president doesn't like to talk about it. But we have whole planes chartered. In fact, there was something on 60 Minutes just a month ago to do something called extraordinary rendition. And extraordinary rendition means basically we send people to other countries to get them tortured. The court ruled that no, you couldn't do that. That actually prisoners, even in Guantanamo Bay, had a right to a hearing, had a right to habeas corpus, actually. And that's another right that comes out of the Constitution. The right about enemy combatants, whether or not you can hold someone in jail indefinitely without charges, without a lawyer, again, comes from the Constitution. So I want to discuss this hour the Bill of Rights, how it is that people interpret the Constitution, and give you really my own views. My own views is I'm a strict constructionist. I'm a textualist. I believe that the words of the Constitution matter. And it's amazing to me because you hear people like Antonin Scalia claim to be strict constructionist, but actually he isn't, and I'll talk about a conversation I had with Scalia personally when I was at Yale Law School, which shows that. But what I would call for and what I'm advocating this hour is for liberals to reclaim the Constitution because it protects us. It truly protects us. And to follow its text and to condemn the many, many, many cases of conservative judicial activism, everything from calling the government a king. Yes, actually, and I'm going to go into it this hour. Actually, the conservatives consider the government to be regal, to be a sovereign, despite the fact that that's exactly what's excluded in the Constitution. I'll give you examples of that. To questions of equality under the law. There are some that believe that they have the right to dictate morality, but what they don't seem to understand is that, yes, the Constitution requires morality under the law. And, of course, this wouldn't be a conversation about the Constitution if we didn't bring up the issue of judicial nominees and the fact that Republicans are really trying to stop the Democratic filibuster of a few of Bush judges. After blocking some 60 of Clinton appointees, they're really concerned about the dozen or so justices that Democrats are blocking. And I want to talk about that too. Where exactly in the Constitution is that language located? So there's a lot to talk about this hour. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. We'll get right back with these constitutional examples and your questions right after these messages.
Credit card companies love you. Giants like Citibank, Chase Manhattan, and NBNA constantly fill our mailboxes with little love letters, wooing us to accept their cards. But, like so many love affairs, once you've signed up, the companies suddenly show an ugly, grasping, selfish side of their personality. What you learn is that credit firms seem to enjoy penalizing their customers. For example, I recently paid a monthly bill of about $1,000 on an NBNA card, but I accidentally wrote a check that was $10 short. The next month, NBNA hit me for an interest finance charge of $21. That's an interest of more than 200% on a $10 debt. Oh, they calmly explained when I called, we don't just assess the penalty on the amount you were short, but on the entire $1,000 that you owed for the month, even though you already had paid $990 of it. Check the fine print of your agreement, they said, lovingly. Perhaps you, like me, try to pay your balance in full each month to avoid such usurious interest rates. But now they've invented a most unloving trick. Most of us assume that our bills are not due until 30 days after we get them in the mail. The banks, however, have oh so quietly shrunk this common grace period to 20 days or less. Also, Citibank and MBNA are among those that now include sneaky fine print specifying an hour that your payment is due, say 1 p.m. on the 20th. Miss it by a minute, and they can whack you with a late fee of up to $39, plus penalty interest rates as high as 30%, even though you think you've paid your bill on time and in full. This is Jim Hightower saying, they stiff their own customers because it's hugely profitable. Credit card banks collected nearly $15 billion from us in penalty fees last year. To fight back, call U.S. PIRG, 212-546-9707.
I'm message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the Constitution and how it's blocking, maybe the last thing that's blocking, a lot of what this administration is trying to do. If you want to call in, we appreciate your calls. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. You know, when just today I read in the newspaper that the suspects that we are sending to be tortured in Syria and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Pakistan went to the courts and they said, you know what? We have a right not to be tortured. Where does this right come from? Well, you know, there actually is an amendment on it. The Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution says, and I quote, excessive bail should not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. No cruel and unusual punishments. No strapping electrodes to people's genitalia. No using dogs to bite people. None of the techniques that George Bush and Don Rumsfeld have been advocating. But it goes further than that. One of the things that I often hear by conservatives is that George Bush's denial of people having a right to go to trial is okay because Abraham Lincoln did it. Let's be clear here. The Constitution generally requires that if you're going to go to jail, you have to be charged with a crime. You have to know what the charges are, and you have the right to find out who the witnesses are that are against you. You can confront those witnesses. That's the language of the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. You can confront witnesses against you. You can have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses. Again, in the Constitution, the idea is that you can force people who don't want to testify, like you may have seen that housekeeper in the Michael Jackson case who didn't want to testify. You can force people to testify and tell the truth about your situation. So clearly, according to the Constitution generally, you cannot hold someone in jail without trial forever. You've got to give them a hearing. Now, there is a principle, and it's a basic Latin principle. Excuse me if I act like a law professor today, but it goes way back into Great Britain. It's called habeas corpus. And habeas corpus means have the body. In other words, you can't arrest somebody. You can't have their body. You can't take them into custody unless you give a reason. Now, George Bush has suspended the writ of habeas corpus. He has said, and in fact, that there's this new doctrine nowhere found in the Constitution called enemy combatants. And if somebody is an enemy combatant, an enemy of the state, we can hold them in jail indefinitely without trial or anything like that. Now, when I've complained about this before, saying, you know, that's not America, that's something that Stalin might do, or that's something that Franz Kafka might write about, I've heard, well, you know, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and therefore it's okay. If Abraham Lincoln did it, clearly it's okay. But there's a big difference between Abraham Lincoln and George Bush. Abraham Lincoln has read the Constitution, understood it very clearly. He was someone who taught himself as a lawyer. He knew the Constitution in and out. And he knew this provision of Section 9 of Article 1 of the Constitution that says, and I quote, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it." Well, obviously, in the Civil War, we were facing a rebellion, right? There's really no doubt about it. And Lincoln was very, very careful, and so when he suspended the writ of habeas corpus, he made an announcement to Congress in a written document citing this part of the Constitution, saying they could only be suspended in the extraordinary case of invasion or rebellion, and he was doing it temporarily. He respected the Constitution of the United States. And that's why, again, I read in my Washington Post today that the courts have found that, yes, people do still have the right of habeas corpus. People have the right to challenge their imprisonment for a lifetime without charges, without lawyers, held without being able to speak to anybody. They're allowed to challenge it because, yes, they still have this right in the Constitution. And these things go on and on. It happens to affect the Terry Schiavo case. I'll get to that in a bit, but I want to get to your calls. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine.
This is Ed from New York, Mark.
Hi, Ed.
Your conversation about the Constitution is very interesting to me. What really bothers me, though, is the Republicans are playing a two-sided game. They respect the Constitution in certain manners, and they don't in others. Let me explain. For example, with regard to freedom of speech, the Republicans take full advantage of that with the so-called Swift Vote ads that took place during the presidential election of this past presidential election. Yet when it comes to the advice and consent of the Senate for the confirmation of judges, the Republicans want to change the rule and get rid of the filibuster for advice and consent of the Senate, which would in effect create a nuclear option. What I'd like first, can you explain to me what is the nuclear option? And then I'd like to ask you some questions about it.
Sure. That's actually, you do make a lot of good points, Ed. And in fact, one interesting thing about the Swift Boat ads is that there are restrictions even on free speech. What the Constitution does, of course, is it lays out these general principles, like you can't abridge freedom of speech. But it was understood even at that time that there were restrictions based on the common law, the most famous being you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. That's a lie. Unless there is a fire, it's okay. That's a lie. Obviously, you can't do that. And you can't, for example, libel someone. You cannot say something that is untrue about someone in a public manner. You could have an opinion. I can say George Bush is an idiot, but I can't say, for example, that true about someone in a public manner. You could have an opinion. I can say George Bush is an idiot, but I can't say, for example, that George Bush raped and killed someone unless it were true. That would be libel, and so there are restrictions even on free speech. I actually happen to think the Swift Boat ads were libelous, and I would have liked to have seen John Kerry do something about that, although it's a little bit more complicated. Again, I think that you got to start with the Constitution. Now, the Republicans are saying, in effect, that the majority of the Senate. Hypocrisy, of course, is amazing. Here you have the Republicans who actually filibustered a Supreme Court justice by the name of Abe Fortas way back in the 1960s, saying there shouldn't be filibusters. And even Bill Frist, Senator Bill Frist, Majority Leader of the Senate, asked to have a vote, never allowed to have a majority vote. So there's definitely a lot of hypocrisy here. But in the question, 50s, even Civil Rights Bill in the 60s, to have a filibuster, you really had to keep talking. You actually had to physically have that filibuster. Those rules have been changed too. But go.
Rules, then how can the.
Each House may determine its own rules. And the rules of the Senate say that you cannot change a filibuster or any other rule without two-thirds of the vote of the Senate. But here's what's called the nuclear option. Here's what the Republicans threaten to do. What they're going to do is they're going to lose a filibuster for a judge. All right, they won't get the 60 votes they need to put in one of these Bush judges. Okay, then the Democrats will say, okay, that's over. And the Republicans will say, no, we need to have a vote on the rules of the Senate. And the rules say very clearly you got to have 60 to break a filibuster. But what they plan to do is they plan to have Dick Cheney go up there and say, actually, the rules which say 60 mean 51, even though the number is 60.
Means 60 and 51 means 51.
Well, basically, Cheney will make a ruling that says black is white. Okay, once he makes that ruling that says black is white, then comes another section of the rules. You see, when there's a dispute over Senate rules, whether or not the rules... What Cheney says is that instead of 60, it really means 51. And then they make a vote on it. And that vote is by the majority. 51 senators, or 50 and Dick Cheney, agree that 60 really is 51. They can outvote those that think that 60 is 60. That's why it's called the nuclear option, because everyone understands that it's a complete violation of the Senate rules and the Constitution. But since the Senate has the power to determine its own rules, and since the Senate has said that it can take things that are ambiguous and use a majority vote to determine things that are ambiguous, if the number 60 is ambiguous, whether the number 60 really means 60 or not, whether, you know, a filibuster is supposed to apply to all proceedings, which is what the Senate rules say, or isn't supposed to apply to all proceedings, then they can have a vote on it. And so the Democrats have said, well, if you respond by such a misuse of the rules, we're going to misuse the rules by basically shutting down everything we have under the power of the rules to do.
How can they do that?
Well, the minority has a decent amount of power in the Senate. There are a lot of things that require unanimous consent. And so the Democrats have said, we're basically going to shut down the Senate. We're going to stop, you know, if anything you want to do, we're going to take the longest possible time. We're going to filibuster everything. We're going to bring this country to a standstill because you're not following your own rules. And that's why it's called the nuclear option, because it's such a severe, the only response to such a severe misuse of the Constitution would be the Democrats actually misusing the rules in response. And now I happen to think if this were ever brought to a court, the court would rule that calling 60-51 is itself a violation of law, but it's not clear they would do so. They may consider this a political issue and stay out of it. I do want to get to another caller, though, Ed, so thanks very much for your call. I do appreciate it. And let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine. Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Hello.
I'm Alice from Humboldt County.
Hi, Alice. How are you?
Okay. I don't think the Bush administration intends to honor much of the Constitution. They might have Gonzales rule at its quaint.
Yes, actually, Gonzales found that the Geneva Conventions, which prohibit a lot of the conduct that we've done in Afghanistan and Iraq, he called them quaint and obsolete. One of the things, for example, that Don Rumsfeld has admitted to doing, concedes doing, is he's been hiding prisoners from the Red Cross, not disclosing them to the Red Cross. Now, the Geneva Convention requires that all prisoners be disclosed to international bodies like the Red Cross. So it was an express violation, but Albert Gonzales, who was the counsel to the president, ruled that the Geneva Conventions were quaint and obsolete. And it's interesting, I can again just point right to the Constitution, where we've got Article 6. And Article 6 says that this Constitution and the laws of the United States and all treaties made or shall be made shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, any other law of any state notwithstanding. The point is that treaties are the law of the land, and that Alberto Gonzales was basically trying to say that the Constitution, which says treaties are the law of the land, was also, you're right, quaint and obsolete, that it didn't apply. It's a good point, Alice.
Okay.
Very much.
I think that.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Okay.
You know, there may be circumstances where a treaty could be quaint or obsolete, and I'll give you an example. All right. Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy, signed a treaty with the Soviet Union. It was then the Soviet Union. It was the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the ABM Treaty, and it was a treaty that prohibited basically the Star Wars-type programs that Ronald Reagan's been starting. Now, now that we have the Soviet Union gone, now that we have Russia, there actually is an argument over whether the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty is quaint and obsolete. After all, it was signed between two countries, one of whom no longer exists. The United States signed the treaty, the Soviet Union no longer exists. There, I think a presidential counsel could argue either way. I lawyers can make good arguments. I could see an argument either way. I could see you say, well, Russia is the successor of the Soviet Union, so the treaty still applies. Or I could see someone saying, no, Russia is really a very different entity from the Soviet Union. It's a democratic government. It has a different territory. It's a smaller territory. So the treaty doesn't apply. There, I think a lawyer like Alberto Gonzales could argue that it's quaint and obsolete. But when it comes to the Geneva Conventions, which the United States has never pulled out of, these are conventions signed after World War II. They're not that old, and they relate to prisoners of war. It seems to me that the Constitution, again, says that if you don't like these treaties, you have to pull out of them. You have to have the president break the treaty and say, I hereby revoke the treaty. You have to have Senate consent and formally pull out of the treaty and say, no, we do not respect international law. We do not respect laws against torture. We want to torture. We want to remove ourselves officially from the community of nations. Now, if George Bush did that, then I think his violations of the Geneva Convention would be legal. As it is, he didn't, and they are illegal. But the problem is the only way to punish someone for illegal acts in the government is by impeachment. Impeachment, of course, is done in the House of Representatives, controlled by Republicans. So we see time and time again the Constitution being misused, but in essence, it's really up to a few judges, people that are prohibiting the torture, people that are prohibiting denying people habeas corpus, keeping people in jail the whole time. It's up to these few judges to tell the Bush administration, hey, the Constitution still prohibits your action. And I happen to believe that a lot of this was in the background of the Terri Schiavo case. Totally apart from what you believe this woman should have had done to her, whether she herself didn't want to live that way, whatever her family wanted. I think that the heart of that case had to do with judges protecting their own constitutional rights. I'll explain when I come back. And if you want to call in, again, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. How do you see the Constitution being upheld or not upheld? And do you agree that liberals need to reclaim the Constitution and become, if you will, strict constructionists like I am, and say that we believe that the text of the Constitution matters and not a lot of this conservative judicial activism? If you want to call in, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
At George W.'s recent National Economic Conference, an entire session was devoted to bashing trial lawyers. And what a rollicking good time it was. A panel of corporate interests wowed the hand-picked audience of Bush partisans with jabs at the lawyers who try to hold wrongdoing corporations accountable to those of us who are harmed. George himself nodded and chuckled as panelists cried about people who sue these business empires. For example, Home Depot CEO Bob Nardelli, a fat cat Bush donor, was there, wailing that his $64 billion a year retailing Goliath is a target for pesky consumers and their lawyers. You've got deep pockets colliding with shallow principles, Bob snorted, drawing guffaws from an appreciative George who is demanding that Congress limit the rights of consumers to bring lawsuits against the Home Depots. Missing from Bush's Bash Fest was Mary Pinturf. Even if invited, though, she wouldn't have come since, well, she's dead. Her head was crushed by a 75-pound box that fell from one of Home Depot's high-stack shelves. Nor could Janessa Horner be there to testify. This 3-year-old's body was shattered by wood fragments when more than a ton of kitchen countertops fell 10 feet from a Home Depot forklift, splitting a main blood vessel in Janessa's brain. She died 4 hours later. Nardelli tries to keep secret the number of people killed or maimed by Home Depot, which has been labeled the most dangerous store in America. But it's known that in 1 year alone, they were getting 185 injury claims per week. Why doesn't Bob do something about it? Because it's more profitable for him to settle with the families than to change the dangerous way his stores operate. This is Jim Hightower saying, and it's even more profitable for him to back his buddy Bush, who will then push a law to keep families like Mary Pinturf's and Janessa Horner's from suing Home Depot for their loss, pain, and suffering.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a feature. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. From Terry Schiavo to torture to town hall meetings, the Constitution, it keeps rearing its head and as being the one document, the one protection that American citizens still have against tyranny. How's that for a lot of T's? So how is it that the Constitution still protects us, and how is it that people are trying to distort the Constitution and really use it as a sword rather than a shield against us? The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine.
April 10th. You're going to be gone until April 10th?
Hello, caller. Are you there?
This is Steve.
Hello, Steve. Yes, you're on the air.
You're going to be gone until April 10th?
I'm going to be gone until April 10th, yes. I'm going to be in Colorado attending the World Conference on international affairs.
I guess so. Then from 3 to 4, maybe I'll have to do some actual work.
Well, what I'm going to do is, at least on the radio, I'm going to run some reruns. And on the weblog, I'll probably also put up some shows that I thought were good shows that maybe you haven't seen before.
Well, getting to the topic at hand, I think the one distortion of the Constitution that is really at the very root of all the problems is this corporate personhood.
That's a good point.
Go ahead. That's just it. The bastardization of the 14th Amendment, I believe, is that.
That's exactly right.
That they claim personhoods, and therefore they claim it where they want to.
That's exactly right. Actually, let me talk a little bit about that because it's one of those things that you know, but I think a lot of people don't realize. The 14th Amendment, of course, is the great amendment, if you will, probably the most important of them all. It was passed right after the Civil War. It's the amendment that says that that the people who were slaves are now American citizens, and it has those magic words that that the United States and no state shall deny without due process of law any person of life, liberty, or property, or the equal protection of the laws. It's a very, very important thing. It protects all of us. But in 1896, what I would consider a conservative judicial activist court said, person shall not deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. Well, corporations can own property, and even though they can't be alive and can't have liberty, as far as I know it, they can own property, and therefore they really are persons, and therefore they have equal rights to you and I.
Now, that was the Santa Clara case?
Yes, that's exactly right, the Santa Clara case.
Now, wasn't it pointed out that decision was not really what the justice said? It's basically what the reporter wrote down?
Well, there is some controversy over that. It's an opinion that's quite old, actually. It's 100 years old, and there is a question of whether it was supposed to apply just to that case or have a broader principle. But since that time, it's been cited more and more often, and now it's considered a matter of law that corporations are persons and have the same rights as you or I. And I remember in my law school class saying, that's ridiculous. Corporations aren't persons. If you want to establish this fiction called a corporation, you can do that. I have no problem with that. Nothing prohibits it in the Constitution. But you can regulate it as much as you will because it's not a person.
It's granted by the people.
Exactly. Correct? That's exactly right, or of every individual state. And even if you look at the text of the 14th Amendment, which I just read to you, it says you can't deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. Well, corporations can own property, but I've never heard them known to be alive or really have any liberty notion.
If corporations were people, then, of course, if you buy a corporation, then you would have that slavery.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Of course, on the other hand, we may find that they soon want to let corporations vote. So that,
are you serious?
Well, no, I'm not serious.
Yeah, okay.
But that's the point. I mean, if their corporations are people, then they could do everything else. But see, what you've given is a great example of conservative judicial activism that people never talk about. But is, you know, when they talk about judicial activism on liberal side, they talk about things like Brown versus Board of Education because there was, of course, a long period of time, Jim Crow laws, where the Constitution was not enforced and blacks were treated as second-class citizens. And so when you might want to call them liberal judges. I would just call them constitutionally accurate judges, found that, yes, actually there is equality under the law. They were considered judicial activists, and people like Rehnquist, for example, very much opposed Brown versus Board of Education, as well as the civil rights decisions that followed that said that blacks have a right to be in the same public places as white people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of examples of conservative judicial activism. And I would just caution, I do think that the Constitution should change with time. And that, mm-hmm. I guess you could say, I have a liberal view. But I would change it with time being true to its words.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a way, I mean, when you call a person a corporation, there's just no basis for that anywhere
right.
in the Constitution.
And the reason I say it's the root of all problems is because they claim to be people, that gives them the power and, I guess, right to donate to campaigns, to lobby. And I just think that corporations should not be allowed to lobby nor donate.
I'll tell you this. It is true that, luckily, as much as – I don't want to overstate the case. Corporations have been held to be persons in certain cases and not in other cases. I mean, we talked about the fact that they can't vote, that you can't own a corporation where you can't own a slave. And states have – in fact, the United States federal government has abolished corporate contributions to campaigns for quite a long time. It comes out of the progressive era of Teddy Roosevelt. The problem is people are finding all the ways around those regulations with soft money. I mean, just to give you a recent example, Texas bars corporations contributing to campaigns. Tom DeLay got a bunch of corporations to contribute to his campaign. Therefore, he broke the law. Therefore, he's likely to be indicted soon for that crime. So as much as this decision was a travesty, and I agree with you, it was, I do think that it hasn't been expanded quite as far as we may fear.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just bring up one last point on that. People say that corporations have the right to free speech because they're persons. And they use that, for example, to say that tobacco, which is a legal product, mm-hmm. they have the right to sell and anything. And I, of course, argue no. I have no problem with Congress regulating the free speech of corporations. Corporations are not persons. We're not going to change how corporations practice religion either.
Right.
They're not persons.
Right.
Thanks very much for your call,
okay,
Steve.
Mark,
I appreciate it. I do want to talk about – there's so many things to talk about when it comes to the Constitution. And I want to respond to some of the comments on the blog. There's been a guy here, sort of a strange right-winger, who's written all kinds of comments here. And I just think it shows the ignorance of some people on how our government works, on how the Constitution works. When he writes about, you know, Bork, denied by lies, he writes, Estrada, denied by lies. You know, I don't know what he means. He never specifies, of course. He never says what he's talking about. This is a guy named Johnny P. and writes on the blog that if Attorney General Gonzalez gave a feeding tube to Terry Schiavo, he'd be on a hit list. You know, it's this kind of rhetoric that I think really tears this country apart. Obviously, it's false. It's completely untrue. I don't know what hit list he's talking about. But it's this kind of rhetoric that I think damages this country. Because let me give you another example of what actually is a libel. It's a libel posted on my website. You know what? Maybe I should take it down because it's libelous. Johnny P. writes that Joe Biden says that Anita Hill was lying about Clarence Thomas. Joe Biden never said that. He never said that at all. Actually, if you look it up, there is Arlen Specter, a Republican congressman, a Republican senator, says that Senator Joe Biden said something about Anita Hill, but Joe Biden never said it. So I don't know. Should I limit free speech? Should I prohibit this libel, which somebody posted on my blog? We'll get to some of those other issues on there, and I do want to talk about Terry Schiavo because I think it's a great example of the separation of powers gone wrong. And I'll get to all of that and your calls. Toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back after these messages.
The ethical treatment of animals has been her life's work. Anna Briggs feels that each dog at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center in Charlestown, West Virginia, from scruffy mutt to sleek purebred, deserves a loving home. All have been spayed or neutered and current with their shots and vaccinations. Plus, the majority of dogs have completed basic obedience training. You can find photos and bios of the dogs at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center website, www.baacs.org. That's BAACS.org. You'll be doing something very nice for the pet you adopt, and it doesn't take long for you to discover how much these pets will help you and add to your quality of life. The Briggs Animal Adoption Center is an affiliate of the National Humane Education Society. For more information, call 304-724-6558 or visit their website, www.baacs.org.
Magellan? No. Well, who knows what Magellan did?
Sail around the world.
Right. Now.
Sometimes, a child who doesn't seem interested is really a child with a speech or hearing problem.
Blackbeard? Who said Blackbeard? And what did Blackbeard do? He was a
pirate.
Time and again, it's been shown that a young student's ability to read and learn begins with speech and language and hearing skills.
Jamie, are you with us? Who can tell us?
He wanted to go to India.
Many communication disorders can be detected early and corrected, so learning and literacy skills can develop normally. Make sure your child has the speech, language, and hearing abilities to keep up in class. For more information, visit ASHA.org, a public service message from the American Speech Language Hearing Association and this station.
New route to
Asia!
Good.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I've been reading comments on the blog by one of my listeners who calls himself Johnny P and writes some pretty angry stuff out there. He seems to really hate gay people. I get that. But I'm trying to understand what he's writing here, and I think it shows just a real fundamental misunderstanding of the Constitution. First of all, Johnny P, let's be clear, is not exactly living on this planet. He thinks that liberals control the government. That would shock, I think, the Republicans who control the Senate, the House, the President, and the courts. But he says that, for example, a judge could rule that anti-abortion protesters can't hand out information in a clinic. Again, showing a fundamental misunderstanding of the laws of freedom of speech. If you disagree with something, if you disagree with abortion, you can hand out anything you want on public property. What you can't do, and you should know this if you protest something, you can stand on public property, you can hand out your literature, you can't block the doors to a clinic, you can't prevent someone from coming in, you can't trespass on the clinic's property, but you can stand on public property and hand out whatever literature you want, and that's true, frankly, no matter what you believe. Now, Johnny P. says he supports the nuclear option. I don't think he understands what the nuclear option really is. Obviously, it would require Dick Cheney to say that 60 is 51. It's very, very strange. And he also says that it's a breach of the Constitution to have universal health care. And again, that's a fundamental misunderstanding. People in America seem to believe that if they like something, it's in the Constitution. If they don't like it, it's not in the Constitution. But Johnny P. says it's unconstitutional to have a program for universal health care, that you have to amend the Constitution if you want to have universal health care. Well, you know, Johnny P., I'm sorry, but you're wrong. Section 8, Article 1 of the Constitution says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes to provide for the general welfare of the United States. Well, you can disagree over whether universal health care is a good thing, is good for the United States or not, but it's kind of hard to argue that health care isn't within general welfare of the United States. Clearly, Congress has the right to do that, and that's why I really want to advocate people looking at the Constitution, or at least asking a lawyer, hey, is this in the Constitution, rather than just believing that whatever you believe is in the Constitution, and if it's not, it's not. Now, one of the things that Johnny P. points out is that he doesn't like, Antonin Scalia doesn't like this either, the fact that some of our justices have recently been citing other countries' laws. And yet, again, any lawyer could tell you that our whole system of laws is based on other countries' laws, specifically based on England's law. In fact, the common law, which is mentioned in the Constitution several times, just to give you an example, it's mentioned in Amendment 7 where it says in suits in common law, you have the right to trial by jury. Common law is exactly that body of law that we inherited from England. We have always used other countries' laws. And in fact, if you look at the early cases, you will see that early Supreme Court cases are replete with examples from English and other laws. This is nothing new. I'm not sure why Justice Scalia is so upset by it, but clearly it's something that we've been using for some time. Now, obviously, if the words of the Constitution are specific, right? If they say, you cannot be held in prison without having access to a lawyer. It says, for example, in Amendment 6, you have the assistance of counsel in your defense. That's just a fact. There's no dispute there. But when it comes to questions like cruel and unusual punishment, which is the issue that was at issue in the death penalty case, what is cruel? What is unusual? Well, America's always looked to other countries to determine evolving standards like that. Now, Johnny P. goes on to give a whole bunch of examples of memos that were illegally stolen, by the way, in violation of the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits searches and seizures without a warrant. There's a bunch of Republicans who actually were working in Congress while I was there who were secretly wiretapping Democrats' computers and were finding all kinds of memos and disclosing them to the press, like the Wall Street Journal. Now, there is a criminal investigation into this. I hope they are discovered and imprisoned for their crimes. I also don't believe that really the ends justify the means. I don't think that people should be condemning the Democrats for memos that were secret, that were never supposed to be disclosed, and that were illegally obtained. But basically what the memos say and what drives Johnny P. so angry is that there are actually groups like those who represent black people, those who represent women, those who represent gay people, that get together and discuss where judicial nominees have ruled against black people or gay people, have denied civil rights under the law. And what they do is they have gone in and they have advocated, they have lobbied, not paid, by the way, but simply lobbied their members of Congress to not support judges that don't support the Constitution's protection of equal rights under the law. Now, Johnny P. is very, very upset about this. He even calls them the gay mafia. But First Amendment guarantees the right of the people to peacefully assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. So I'm not sure why he has such a problem with that. Johnny P., by the way, refused to call in. I invited him several times to call in and to answer me, but he obviously did not want to do that. Of course, it's quite clear that people do have the right, and people on both sides do it. They lobby their government. Our Constitution requires it. He also seems to believe that the 14th Amendment, which did give black citizenship, and that it only applies to blacks, that blacks get equal protection under the laws, but women and gay people, and he really hates gay people, they shouldn't have equal protection under the laws. But again, I read Amendment 14. And it says that no state can deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, it doesn't say any straight person. It doesn't say any heterosexual. It doesn't even say man or woman. It says any person. So, you know, I am a strict constructionist. I believe that persons mean people. They don't mean corporations, but they do mean people. And yes, I'm crazy in that I believe that gay people have every rights that every other American citizen has. One of the things that Johnny P. writes when he attacks gay people is he attacks the decision of the Supreme Court to overrule the decision of the Colorado voters, where the majority voted to deny equal rights to gay people. But, of course, a majority cannot violate the Constitution. That's exactly the point of the Constitution. We would not need the Bill of Rights protecting minority rights if the majority could simply vote and say, I'm sorry, I don't think gay people should have equal rights. So he wants to know, do I think that gay people have the right to marry? Of course they do, just as straight people do. It's equal rights under the law. Now, I do think that Congress can prohibit marriages that are not based on consent, right? They can prohibit marriages to a child or something like that. They can prohibit unequal marriages. Like, for example, if someone wanted to marry 20 people, that would be unequal. They'd get 20 benefits instead of one. They can prohibit that. But clearly, equal rights under the law means that you have to apply the law equally to everybody else. Again, I invited Johnny P. to come in and call in, but he's obviously doesn't believe he can defend his arguments very much, and he hasn't done so. So let me go on and just quickly talk about a few more of the things that I think are important in keeping the Constitution in mind. One is in the Terri Schiavo case. whatever you feel about her rights, about the husband, the parents, what she wanted, whatever you feel about that, I hope you would you'd be against what Congress did in this case, because the founders very much decided from the beginning that the executive, legislative, judicial branches of government should have very different things to do. The legislature writes the law, the executive enforces the law, and the judiciary interprets the law. And they understood, and it's all written in the Federalist Papers, that by dividing up these three different capabilities, it was a way to protect everyone's rights, to actually keep everyone guarding what they do right. That should not be the same person, should not make the law, enforce the law, and interpret the law. So what did they do in Terry Schiavo's case? Well, the state courts interpreted the law. And Congress didn't like their interpretation of the law. So what they're supposed to do in that circumstance is, well, actually nothing, because it was a state law. The state of Florida could pass a new law, but they didn't, changing the law. And the federal government really didn't have power to intervene. How do we know? Well, one way we know is the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which says that powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution are reserved to the states or to the people. And there is no power in the Constitution given to Congress to make a life or death decision. That is a power reserved to the states. So Congress violated the Constitution, in my view, and I think that's why the judges refused to hear the case. It wasn't so much that they believed one side or the other of Terry Schiavo, but they were jealously guarding their powers, as they should, and saying, this is something that belongs in state court. That's what the Constitution says. Congress had no right to intervene and shouldn't have intervened. Let me go quickly to a caller who's just called in before we end up. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine.
It's Dave, and I just wanted to wish you a good break, Mark.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm actually going to be on a panel with Molly Ivins on Social Security, which I'm looking forward to. And when I come back on April 10th, I'm going to be on Air America that evening. It'll all be broadcast from my website. So thanks very much, Dave. I appreciate your call.
Have a good one, brother.
Thanks. Let me just real quick, and I only got about 3 minutes left, but just talk about – oh, what? We got another caller. All right, we'll take the caller. Caller, go ahead.
It's important that we speak with you.
Oh, it looks like, I don't know, it's a sales call. Yikes. All right, that's what happens when I take calls quickly at the end of the hour. Let me just quickly say that I do think the Constitution can evolve over time, and there's been some question about that, that that's a liberal view. Well, all you really have to do is look at the Fourth Amendment. This is the amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures. It says, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, particularly describing what's to be seized. Now, that means basically the government cannot monitor what you're doing without a warrant. Okay? In the Patriot Act, the government does precisely that. And I would ask those of you who say, well, you know, we didn't have computers back in the 1700s. All we had were papers. To me, the strict constructionist view, and it's the view I have, is to follow the language of the text. And what is the language of the text? It says the people shall be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And if effects doesn't mean your computer, your telephone, if it doesn't mean the government does not have a right to wiretap everything you do, then I'm not quite sure what it means. You know, there's a reason why the founders of the United States didn't have too many specifics in the Constitution. Yeah, they say you have to be 30 to be a senator and 25 to be a congressman. But they left things open like papers and effects or freedom of speech because they understood that in every generation we would use the language of the Constitution for our day. And that's exactly what the Constitution is supposed to do. And so I argue that a strict constructionist can be a liberal and can change over time. And unfortunately, we have people like Justice Scalia who are using the Constitution for other things. One last example, and I know there's a caller on the line, but I only have a minute left. Let me give you one last example, and that is the issue of sovereign immunity. Now, you've probably never heard of this example, but Scalia has held that the government is a king. The government replaced the King of England, and therefore you cannot sue the government. For example, they held that the state of California, that a university that in the state of California can steal someone else's patent because, well, they're the state, and you can't sue the state. Now, that language is nowhere in the Constitution. It's nowhere there at all. It's nowhere there at all. He says it's in the 11th Amendment. It's not. Read the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment just says that a citizen of a foreign state can't sue the state itself. It doesn't say that no one can sue their own state. But this is another example of conservative judicial activism. So I argue we need to be against judicial activism. We need to stick to strictly construing the text of the Constitution. It's worked for 200 years. It will continue to work well into the future. That's it for the Inside Scoop. I hope you've enjoyed the show today. It is true. I will not be back until Sunday, live at least, until Sunday, April 10th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the Weekly Review. And then Sunday at 9 p.m., I'll be broadcasting on Air America across the nation on Laura Flanders Talkers Roundtable. If you are in the Colorado area or one of the neighboring states, drive on up to Boulder. Check out on my website. It's going to be a terrific conference. Until then, I'll be playing some of my reruns. I hope you'll enjoy them and you haven't heard them before. This is Mark Levine signing off.